Hello, and welcome to the Unrestricted Area, presented by Basketball Intelligence. Go to basketballintelligence.net to receive your daily email with links to the best basketball reporting every day. And I do mean every day. It's 7 days a week. Today, my partner Ray LeBove and I are joined by NBA analyst Seth Partnow and IP expert Mike Kasdan to discuss the ongoing Knicks-Raptors lawsuit. It's a fascinating deep dive full of both basketball and legal nuances, and I learned a ton. I hope you do too. Thanks.
Welcome, everyone, to the Unrestricted Area podcast sponsored by Basketball Intelligence. With me today is Mike Shearer, who's going to co-host this with me.
Hello.
In the news in the last few days has been kind of a bombshell of something very unusual happening with the New York Knicks suing a former employee and the Toronto Raptors, alleging trade secret theft and other intellectual property issues, among others. And it's very, very early, of course, in that process. We're just at the complaint stage. So we don't know a lot other than what's been made public and what people have been writing about it. And there's so much to unpack, and that will continue for some time. There are all sorts of legal questions and all sorts of basketball issues that are raised by this complaint. And we have the great fortune to have with us today two experts, both on the legal and basketball side of things. And each of them are experts on the legal and basketball side. So that makes it even better. We have with us Mike Kasdan, attorney with Wiggin and Dana, who is recognized as a giant in intellectual property, trade secrets, et cetera, law. When I was checking his resume or CV, it's like, okay, I have other things to do than to spend my entire day reading his resume. So he's a giant in the field, adjunct professor as well at NYU Law School and Seton Hall Law School. So thanks to Mike for joining us. In addition, a recurring guest for us, he's appeared on our podcast in the past, Seth Partnow, formerly director of basketball research for the Milwaukee Bucks, author of the book Mid-Range Theory, which we've had him on to discuss a couple times, and very prominent author currently at The Athletic and other places where, I'm not sure, are you freelancing, Seth? Is that what that is, or...?
I'm contributing a number of different places, in addition to kind of working on data products behind the scenes.
Yeah. So, wow, we're very, very fortunate to have with us these two today. So I want to start off by just sort of setting the stage a little bit. And of course, the conversation can go wherever the two of you want it to go. But let's start with Mike. Tell us what the main allegations are that form the basis of the complaint.
Yeah, sure. And thanks so much for having me on and for that really kind introduction. I don't know if I've been called giant without reference to my weight for a long time. It's kind of nice to hear, but I appreciate it. But so this complaint by the Knicks against the Raptors, and also naming the incoming head coach and some other coaches and a bunch of John Does for people whose names they don't yet know, is a civil complaint filed in the Southern District of New York. And at the heart of it, it's a trade secret misappropriation case. They have claims in there under the federal Defend Trade Secrets Act, under the common law New York trade secrets, and then a bunch of claims that arise out of the same facts, which, you know, it's alleged that there's this, one Knicks employee who is in the video and analytics department taking a job with the Raptors, and on his way out, taking and sending to the Raptors a sort of whole host of information. From the Knicks, we can get into the details of it, but basically, it's interesting because, you know, a lot of trade secret cases in the non-sports world arise out of this combination of employees moving around from one place to the other, and how easy it is to take stuff and how valuable data is. And this is, you know, that happening in the sports context. And, you know, in this era of analytics, that's really the focus of, you know, what these trade secrets are. And, you know, the allegations, by naming, you know, Darko, you know, the incoming coach, you know, they're pretty serious. So that's basically what this complaint is all about. I think it's unique. A lot of times these types of disputes, well, it's rare to see these types of disputes. I don't know that I've seen one just like this. Closest thing I can think of in recent memory is the Cardinals Astros thing from maybe, you know, 7-8 years ago. But, you know, we usually see all these issues dealt with at the league level. So it's quite an interesting thing to see it filed in court and to see this, you know, play out so publicly.
You know, that raises a couple of questions for me, and they're related. The first one is, what's the usual practice? Obviously, if somebody's working for a team and they move to another team, they can't help but bring some things with them. And of course, they have NDAs. What do those say and how do they affect what they're able to bring? They have to bring some stuff. You can't forget everything that you've learned. So what's the usual practice? Are there written or unwritten rules that typically govern? And when, after we've explored that a little bit, I'd like to get into there, of course, the nature of the NBA as an association has, by virtue of the nature of the association, by virtue of its rules, it's required on some level that for a dispute like this, that it gets settled in house or attempt to be settled in house first, whether that's an exhaustion of remedies or something else, I'm not exactly sure. But so I think those two are related. But if we could start with the first one, maybe Seth, if you could address that.
So I don't want to say that everyone who works for an NBA team is subject to an NBA and a non and or some form of non-compete, but I would surmise that the vast majority of employees are subject to one or both. And those tend to be, especially with in terms of kind of the non-disclosure bits, written pretty broadly, like, you know, processes and materials, blah blah blah. And I say blah 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 because I think it is extremely common for people when changing jobs from one team to another to have something that they brought with. And it's something in addition. Obviously, Mike, you can speak to this more more expertly than I can. But obviously, like, what's in your head is not, you know, okay, well, I know how to do this analysis. I know how to, I don't have to relearn how to perform a regression. I don't have to relearn how to do a film cut up. That's obviously not protected by that. But the usual pattern is there's some examples of work product that find their way from one facility to the next. And generally speaking, those are much more about sort of the form rather than the substance. I'm glad you brought up the sort of the scouting database case in baseball, because I think that there's some pretty important things that probably, at least as alleged in the complaint, as far as I can tell, are very distinguishable from that situation. So it's like, okay, well, here's how we do a play call. We did a play call report. Here's how we did it's much more the form, because, you know, a scouting report is stale pretty quickly. So it's not like you would get a whole bunch from most of the things that certainly in sort of printed form might find their way into a knapsack.
Yeah, I mean, I can jump in just to add a little bit there, because, you know, I think the question that I think a lot of people think about in today's day and age, you know, you have your laptop, you have your work laptop, you have your home laptop, maybe it's the same laptop, you have all sorts of stuff from work that you probably work on at home. And, you know, and I think in this age, it's a very common question, right? Like, when you're leaving one job, like, what can you take? What can't you take? What are the rules, you know, written or unwritten or legal? And, you know, last year, actually, like, I talked to the Washington Post. We did this sort of general article about, you know, like, what's good practice when you're leaving one place and going to another to sort of stay clean and make sure you're not getting into trouble. And, you know, I think the issue is, you know, like Seth said, you know, usually in your employment agreement, most sophisticated employers are going to have, you know, some sort of confidentiality obligation and or a non-compete, you know, and or something that tails. And here in the complaint, like paragraph 30, part of establishing the confidentiality of these materials, you know, they have the employment agreement at issue here, you know, to talk specifically about maintaining confidential, you know, tactics and strategies, all the, you know, scouting reports, you know, trade strategies, playbooks, etc. And also says that when you're terminated, Or at the end of this agreement, you have to return all that to the company. So I think, you know, some of us say, well, sure, you know, I did that. But if you did it in the course of your employment, sure, you take what's in your head. But I think, you know, usually you want to be very careful as to what you take, you know, from one employer to especially another competing employer. The other thing that I see out there is that as part of sophisticated, you know, companies, and, you know, these two certainly are, just out there in the world, very careful when you're onboarding new employees, right? If you're hiring someone, especially from a competitor, to do the same job, when he's coming, when he or she is coming in the door, you want to have a process that says, hey, let's make sure you don't have any of that stuff, because we don't want to, it's one thing for you to have a problem, it's another thing to start a big problem for the company. So obviously the allegations, you know, say that that's kind of the opposite of what happened here. Yeah.
And it seems like the Raptors, part of the thing is that they didn't have any processes in place at all, right? Like that's some of the motivation that has been kind of, you know, talked about a little bit online, at least, as like they were trying to stand up, kind of skip a few steps, I suppose, in getting sort of their operational processes in place, which is unusual. I know that they had.
And surprising.
They had replaced some of their leadership, right? And Seth, I see you kind of shaking your head a little bit, like Obviously new coach and stuff, but you'd imagine some infrastructure, like Mike was talking about, would still be there.
There's a, you know, you write a complaint in a certain way and stretch the facts to
tell a story.
Yeah. You tell a story that I suppose a reading of the facts. I think that there's certainly some pretty florid language in the complaint that, you know, it's like, well, this guy's a bumpkin, therefore ... And that's like,
right.
I mean, again, I don't know any of the parties involved, but that's frankly a pretty ridiculous assertion on its face. But as far as the notion that there are these processes in place, I think one thing this comes down to is there is within sports organizations, there is sort of a bifurcation between the business office, the business operations side of thing, which does tend to operate in a very sort of sophisticated best practices sort of way. And Then the sports ops side, where it's a little more rip and run. And it's certainly in like coaching, the pattern and practice of like coaching, like it's you take what you've learned. It's everyone steals homage. It's like, you know, in music, it's everything is an homage, is a piece of something else that influenced me. So that's, there aren't really, especially in this day and age of widespread film, there is not a whole lot of things that are actually secret in that regard. So I can't even imagine what a process would look like where you hire a video coordinator or hire a coach. It's like, and make sure you don't have anything anywhere. That's in context. I don't even know how that would apply to the actual practice of how this has been done for, in any sport, for, you know, 100 years.
Yeah.
So, Seth, when you were working for the Bucks, I assume that a lot of what you were doing from an analytical perspective was kind of boilerplate, was kind of what other teams were doing. But I would assume, from what I've heard from other people who run analytics departments, that some of it's proprietary. That you don't want to share because it, in theory, at least gives you an edge. And why would you want other teams to be able to do the same thing that you're doing? So a multi-part question here. Do we see any of that type of thing here where any of the allegations look like they're talking about truly proprietary stuff? And at the same time, I guess I would ask if the allegations as articulated in the complaint prove to be true, is there anything there that you see that would be of particular import to as a plus for the Raptors or as a minus for the Knicks? It's kind of a two-part question.
So I'll take the back part first. By and large, no. It seems like a lot of the stuff that's being discussed is pretty standardized. There's some specific allegations around the use of the Synergy platform, which I suppose plausibly could go into some actual competitively advantageous stuff, but Synergy is basically something that's used in every front office, and there's not a lot of customizability within and it's the same film is available to everybody, is saving the time of this person having to recreate the same edits again Is that a competitive advantage? I don't know. I mean, the guy is it a competitive advantage to not have the guy sleep on a couch in the office for 10 days in the off season? Plausibly. But now there are some inferences and allegations, I guess, about sort of proprietary note taking, and that plausibly gets into sort of the actual competitively advantageous stuff, which would be, you know, detailed scouting reports, intel reports, player value models, things like that. On balance, it doesn't really seem like that's what's being alleged in the complaint, because I think that things like that would have been trumpeted if there was, well, this included our proprietary, you know, plus minus model, or our drafts, you know, ranking algorithm, the output of it, or something like that. And those things, you know, some of those things, especially if they're revolving around sort of past evaluations, those are sort of in a gray area between actually advantageous and more just sort of appearing like they are. Those things are much more from an actual use standpoint, much more perspective looking, like how would our model project guys going forward? How would we, what's our current understanding of kind of league intel and stuff like that? That's absolutely proprietary information. And that, you know, again, that's what the Astros Cardinals case was about, is this is like the actual scouting database, which was being accessed there. And I think that's a very different thing than a film repository that basically you log in with different credentials and you get to see and do the same stuff.
So, oh, I'm sorry, go ahead, Mike.
No, I was going to say, I think that's a really interesting perspective, because, and I think that's sort of one reason why at the complaint stage, you know, when people say, oh, well, you know, is this serious and how serious it is, it's always hard to assess. And I think that, you know, Seth's kind of insight from doing this type of stuff and seeing these types of things is far different from mine, because when I read this, just objectively, the way, and of course the complaint is written this way, but you know, it looks like, hey, this is a bunch of really proprietary stuff. And I think, when you take it apart, when you look at it, there are certainly issues. Like I look at things like in the complaint, you know, emailing to the Raptors or to himself, the prep book for the 22-23 season that includes confidential information relating to the Knicks process for planning in season. Now, without knowing what that looks like, that sounds like, wow, that's really proprietary. Goes on to say, including the template and organizational structure that the Knicks use to plan and assign scouting responsibilities. And I'm like, well, I mean, I don't even know if that's confidential at all. So, you know, when you look at each of these, you know, alleged trade secrets, when you get into it, I think there are a couple different ways to look at it. One is, you know, is this stuff really kept do you consider this to be a trade secret? And I think points like Seth made of like, hey, you know, people take this stuff all the time, it's industry practice, you know, that might go to the issue of, you know, do you really consider this super confidential and proprietary and act that way? The other side of that is the value of it, right? Like how valuable is it? And I think, you know, in the ordinary case, and I think there is some sort of pushing on that too, but because in the ordinary trade secret case, you don't have this concept of like the game within the business. So ordinarily you're talking about, you know, the trade secret definition, the bar is pretty low. It has to be, you know, secret and give you some sort of commercial or economic advantage. That's usually talking about out in the marketplace, like selling widgets or, you know, and so here it's like, well, arguably that gives you some advantage. Maybe looking at the diagrams of the Denver Nuggets and all the different ways, you know, Jokic beats you is useful for them to have for their game planning. Although, you know, Seth's way more familiar with these with the types of data that this is. But even if it is, we're talking about not marketplace value, unless you sort of indirectly say, and therefore, you know, we lost one more game to the Raptors and people lost, you know, bought less tickets or whatever, but it's certainly not a direct kind of marketplace effect like you have in ordinary case. You're talking about on the court stuff. So I think that goes to sort of the value and damages part, but on the liability side, it's the issues that Seth was raising, looking at each of these and saying, okay, like, is it kept confidential? And maybe all these things are confidential and maybe they can sort of cross the low bar that you need legally to show it's a trade secret and they kept it confidential. And maybe, you know, maybe the value part is harder for them, but certainly there are issues that are there to think about.
This, it seems to me, and I've spoken to friends of mine here that practice some of this kind of law. And it does seem like even with the sort of the general pattern and practice of the league, and I wanted to ask you about that in general, how that might affect the disposition, but it seems like the sort of the the establishment of wrongdoing, the liability phase of this, and the damaging, the damages phase are kind of completely different aspects. I mean, it's even if it's something that everybody does, it might still technically be trade secrets. Right. But I can say that from I've talked to a couple dozen people who either currently or formerly worked for teams, and the universal response has been, "What's the big deal?"
Right.
sort of like so it's this was done. It's sort of the stuff that is done as a matter of course, just in a particularly clumsy way, seems to be the general consensus and reaction of and pretty universal among people I've talked to, kind of in and around these positions.
Yeah, I haven't used Synergy, and I certainly don't use it in my day job like those folks do. But you know, the part that was striking to me is like, yes, they took this stuff for game 82 against the Mavericks, and this stuff for game and maybe player tendencies, and you know, maybe there's some value there where you can technically prove it's a trade secret. How much, you know, we can debate. But maybe, you know, if you're taking the kindest view towards the Raptors, and certainly clumsy is kind, because you know, you're emailing stuff from your work account to your Gmail account after you've given notice, like it's. You know, I think taking the kindest view, you know, it's maybe like maybe he felt like he did those breakdowns and they were his, and so he's just taking them with. And they're really not, and kind of everyone does that. I think still that could be a technical violation. I think the part that felt, you know, like it crossed another line, was, you know, the access, the thousands of access to all these clips, and I think that turns to me on like how, you know, how much in there is proprietary comments, and how much is there is their customized view of the world that gives you insight into their, you know, the inner workings, and that I just don't know. So I think that's kind of, I don't know. That's an interesting question.
I'd say that some of that also, I mean, it really, there's a lot of squishiness in what that actually is, depending on how you're navigating the tool. Like that could literally be like 12 clicks. Could you get you to like, you know, and then from there you narrow down. So it's, you know, how much was accessed versus what was actually like. You know, there's a lot of film out there, and sure, Synergy can get you to a lot of film pretty quickly. So that number seems large. That could easily be like, I could easily see that you can get to that in like 5-10 minutes. So depending on not knowing the specifics of kind of what was done. So again, it's one of those things that sounds like very expansive, but if you actually use the tool, it's less so, I guess.
Yeah. And Seth, you'd asked, oh, sorry, go ahead, Ray.
No, you go and then I'll follow up.
Yeah, no, just to close the loop on, you know, so Seth, you were asking about, you know, how much evidence of, you know, industry practice, you know, might come to bear. And that turns into like an evidence question in the lawsuit. I think generally in lawsuits, it focuses kind of on the wrongdoing that's alleged and not, you know, facts about third parties, which have to be explored and might be prejudicial to bring that in. But I think there are ways to bring that type of evidence in because I think it is relevant to things like value and things like confidentiality. So, you know, that's kind of my take on that.
I mean, I was like, you know, putting the hat on, I was like, okay, I'm the Raptors lawyer. How much am I looking forward to deposing every single member of the Knicks basketball operations department that previously worked for another team and asking them under, you know, under threat of perjury? So these NDAs, did you sign them? So tell me more about all the things you didn't take. And then, you know, it's maybe you get like, nope, never, we didn't. But I mean, that seems like it would be very impeachable testimony based on, you know, the general pattern and practice of the league. So I'm just, is that relevant as all? Is that more embarrassing, or is that like, we didn't think this all the way through when we decided to go in, you know, guns blazing with the lawsuit?
Well, to follow up and to reiterate what we said at the very beginning, that this has just happened and all that's happened right now is a complaint with allegations.
Right.
And, but to the extent, and we've heard a dialogue over, is there significant proprietary stuff or not? And what would the impact be? Maybe no impact, maybe a big impact. We won't know for some time, but assume for the moment that there is actionable things that happened that, you know, not necessarily hugely important, but proprietary to an extent and impactful to an extent. How would the Knicks be, this is a two-part question, how would the Knicks be made whole in that instance if that were to happen? And then assume for the moment that part of that is in damages. How would damages be calculated?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's one of the things that leapt to mind as I was reading this, because like I mentioned before, there are a couple of levels of challenge they have on the damages side. One is, you know, coming up with the economic harm from the sharing of these materials when they are, you know, at best, you know, analytics that may affect on-court performance. And even then, like, does this cost you a game or not? Like, who knows? It's very speculative. And then, so I think damages, you know, usually, you know, the Defend Trade Secrets Act is commonly used, and that's the Federal Trade Secret Act. The damages, people are very successful in collecting big damages awards in trade secret cases where there's more directly, where the proofs kind of more directly line up. And by that, I mean, there are choices under the Defend Trade Secrets Act for how you get damages. It's a very broad remedial statute. You can get damages based on lost profits. So if your competitor, and again, that's easier to imagine in a case where, like, I'm working on self-driving car technology and my chief engineer goes and takes it to a competitor and they beat us to market by 6 months and they're selling self-driving cars for $30,000 a pop, and we project that we lost X amount, and you do the math, and boom, that's our lost profits. You can also get what's called disgorgement. You can recover the profits of the wrongdoer. You can also, you know, say, if it's, and sometimes profits are hard to prove in either case, but you can come up with some sort of royalty rate, you know, based on their sales. All of those theories, at least, you know, to me at this point, they're hard to apply in this context, because what's the thing that you're selling more of or less of? What's the harm? It's really hard to quantify. So I think they're going to have to get a really creative damages expert, because I think that part of the case is very challenging for them.
So there's sort of two avenues that occurred to me. One is sort of the, I don't know. And again, you tell me if this is like the cost of production. Like, for example, the allegations are the main defendant used the Nix Synergy login for approximately 3 weeks. What's the prorated seat cost of 3 weeks? It's non-zero. I mean, Synergy is a pretty expensive bit of software that teams spend a lot of money on. So that's, you know, but that's not it's not enough to make a federal case out of, literally. But the other one is, I mean, if we're actually able to, now you say the on-court impact is speculative, and like, taking aside how you would prove what the on-court impact would be, I think that there are plenty of, I mean, I do the exercise all the time myself in, okay, win worth. And you can, how much is a win worth by what does the NBA pay in salary to players for each win? So, I mean, that gets you, okay, you know, for this year, I've basically used an estimate of about $3.75 million per win. Now, is that more or less? That doesn't seem like a, if you were able to prove that this like gave the Raptors two wins at the expense of the Knicks, like, and you said that is like, and that is a value of $7.5 million. Mm-hmm. I think that's a very credible argument. Getting from stuff taken to that two wins, that's going to be the last mile of the analysis is.
Yeah, I think that type of creative argument is one I could see. And it's interesting, right? It's a case about kind of analytics. And so having an analytics-y kind of what's the value of a win, and here's how we came up with the damages theory, is kind of interesting.
Can I ask maybe a simpler question, which is, why do we think the Knicks would do this, especially if it's fairly common practice? I've heard theories, you know, ranging everything from James Dolan is still really mad about the Andrea Bargnani trade, all the way up to like, actually, this guy probably took something that is a lot more damaging than we realize. It just hasn't come out yet. Like, I'm wondering, like, this is a very unusual avenue for one team to take against another. Usually you would imagine this stuff would be kept in-house, and we can talk about that further as well. But I'd like to know, like, what motivation the Knicks could have here, really.
Can I ask a question on top of that? Because I think it's one that I've had, and I was hoping Mike could answer. It seemed like the sort of the demand letter that the Knicks sent, which it was reporting was it happened late last week, and then they filed a lawsuit early this week. That seems pretty quick. And so I'm wondering in terms of if that sort of narrowness in time casts any light on Mike's question.
Yeah, I mean, so it's all guesswork, right? And but I mean, here we are, so I'm happy to do a little bit of guesswork with the caveat that that's all it is. But And I think we should also get into the issue of why they chose to do this rather than going to the league, for example, and whether they had to go to the league and whether the Raptors can force this into the league. That's kind of a separate question. But your interesting question and the question layered on top of it. So first of all, you know, lots of things get resolved without going to litigation. Sometimes, you know, you file a lawsuit and then you resolve it right afterwards. Sometimes you have to litigate for a while. You know, certainly sometimes people don't even send demand letters and they file a lawsuit and they say, hey, you know, here it is, you know, for strategic reasons. You know, Dolan's known to be a pretty aggressive transactional type guy. So this is a pretty bold kind of thing. So one, I think there's an emotional layer. So clearly, like, someone at a high level was really pissed. And maybe there's more to it. Like you're saying, Mike, there's going to be, if this case proceeds, broad discovery, right? And maybe there are other stuff that come out. And when you get into these documents, you know, maybe, you know, there are, you know, a lot more, you know, troubling, you know, materials. And this is just kind of what they found out in the last couple of days of this guy's employment when they started tracking him. So that's always possible. But I think when you think about why do people file a lawsuit or take one strategic path versus the other, you know, there's an emotional level. And look, there's also, you know, it's sports and it's Dolan's, and you know, there is a competitive aspect to it. Like, this is a pretty difficult you know, first thing to happen in your new job for the coach of this rival in your division before he sits down at his desk. So it certainly creates chaos and turmoil. So you know, that could be part of it. But I mean, I think also when you know maybe it could be just, you know, to create leverage. And by that I mean, you know, maybe the Knicks feel this is serious or and feel very wronged and feel like, you know, this puts some pressure on the league to not deal with it as a slap on the wrist, to not sort of just, you know, dock someone a second round draft pick and move on kind of thing. And just sort of elevates it and sort of takes control of the narrative a little bit. Now how the league feels about that and the interplay between, you know, the commissioner and the Knicks, you know, that's a complicated, you know, thing on its own. But, you know, it could, a lot of times I think you have to look at like leverage, and it seems like the Knicks chose this path because they feel like they're going to get more out of it by putting more pressure on the league to take it really seriously and thinking, hey, this is going to back into a league investigation, but they know we have this in our pocket and they don't really want that. Or just, you know, going forward with the lawsuit and saying, hey, yes, we've never had these types of things, you know, tried in civil courts, and the league doesn't really want that. Nobody really wants that, but, you know, we feel really serious about this and we're going to push it. And you know, there are personality types that push and think that it gets them more. And, you know, sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't.
Mike, if I could follow up on that, and I'm not sure how much of this has come out or how much is already known, but it's from what I've read, there's two things that could be operative here. One is by virtue of the nature of the league and having teams that belong to an association rather than being totally independent entities. Is there something in the law? It seems to be, people have written about this, that means that filing a lawsuit might not be appropriate. And I guess you could add to that, in addition to by virtue of the nature of the relationship, there seems to be some agreement among the teams to have the disputes settled, at least attempt to be settled in-house first, yes. If I'm reading correctly, and you're probably very knowledgeable about this. So to the extent that that's true, could that be very significant here in terms of how this might play out?
Yeah, I mean, I think it could. And so I'm not very knowledgeable about it, but I have looked, but I do know that, you know, all the sports leagues vest pretty broad powers in their commissioners to deal with disputes between members, you know, including teams. A lot of the disputes in the past have been more like rules violations. Like tampering is the one that comes up that you think about, where the commissioner gets involved. That's a dispute between two teams, and the commissioner comes down and says, hey, you broke the rules and here's a penalty. But I did look up that, so the NBA constitution, and like you said, the NBA, there's a league, and you know, the teams are all members of that league, and they have a constitution, and you can find it online. But Article 24 of the NBA constitution says the commissioner shall have exclusive, full, complete, lawyers are sometimes very repetitive, just in case it was unclear. Exclusive, full, complete, and final jurisdiction of any dispute involving two or more members of the association. Now, that's super broad. It doesn't say rules, disputes. It says, you know, full, final, complete, exclusive jurisdiction. So when I read that, that makes me think that David Silver is the only person who can adjudicate this issue. Now, I don't think that this provision and its meaning has been really tested before by an actor who said, okay, well, I'm just going to ignore that and see what happens. And, you know, I can see there being arguments about what this means, not because the words are unclear, but how it operates procedurally. Does this just mean that David Silver can start his investigation and say, hey, I see this dispute, I'm going to have an investigation and I'm going to award, you know, I'm going to resolve it. Or, you know, can the Raptors respond to the complaint? Oh, I'm sorry, I said, I meant Adam Silver. But can the Raptors in responding basically move to dismiss, almost like, you know, as if two parties had an arbitration clause and agreed to arbitrate their disputes, and then one of them files a lawsuit. What you get in those cases is the other party doesn't even respond to the complaint other than to say, nope, we're supposed to arbitrate it and this isn't the right place. Can the Constitution be used by them in that way? Those are kind of unanswered legal questions because I don't think this issue has come up before. But if you look at that language, it seems that if you're a team and you're a member of this Constitution, you've given Silver the ability, the exclusive, full, complete, and final jurisdiction to deal with the dispute. And this is certainly a dispute. So that's a head scratcher. And again, like I say, you back out of like the legal stuff and you think about motivation, you think about leverage, and, you know, filing this lawsuit, you know, puts the commissioner in an interesting position. And, you know, maybe Seth, no, I just know what I read as a basketball fan, but, you know, the relationship between owners and commissioners, it's not like the commissioner is always the big boss man of all the owners. It's a more, there's more mutuality there. Right. So like, you know, will Silver now come in and for one of his owners, you know, break up the lawsuit? How does that really play out? I think those are interesting questions, but legally, I think it's a good question. And when you look at the Constitution, it sure seems like it's a league issue and that they may have given up, you know, jurisdiction in other places to deal with disputes.
So there's two aspects of that I think are interesting. One is, I think that the league very much does not want teams suing each other.
I agree.
And so, wanting to like, no, this is our issue, just on the standpoint of the broader thing. Like, we want to keep all disputes in house.
Yes.
On the other hand, in a vacuum, how much does the league actually want to be policing this particular thing? It strikes me in many ways sort of like the tampering discussions where it's like, all right, there's not really anything we can do about it. Just like, don't make us look like idiots. So, and, you know, we'll levy, you know, we'll find a second round draft pick, you know, occasionally for like the most egregious cases. But
yeah. I think that's why the Knicks have stockpiled all these second round draft picks.
So that they can tamper away. You're building up a cash for winner, right?
But to your point, it's a can of worms, right? So if you start getting into this, it's going to be really hard to know when to stop.
Well, and also I'm just like, I'm thinking, you know, my thoughts sort of naturally go to people who are in sort of the role that I used to have and the people kind of lower down in orgs and how much like BS this is going to put on their plates in terms of like crackdowns on communication and just make life for everybody worse because like someone decided to, you know, file a lawsuit about something that everyone does. There are multiple cans of worms. And again, I don't know how much the league wants to be in the business of having to adjudicate disputes about what is and is not proprietary trade secrets in the context of, again, the sort of the very incestuous world of basketball analysis and coaching. This is, you know, generally speaking, people get promoted by changing teams. That's sort of how it works in general. And then all of a sudden, now you're imposing this giant friction on that sort of movement between teams and wondering, does that hurt everybody? Start like from the team level on down to like the lowest intern. This has the potential to make just life worse.
I think those are great points about the league's interest. I'll push back gently. I think there is an interest in letting people move around freely, and there's a big push in the country against kind of agreements that inhibit that, which is kind of interesting. But I will push back a little gently, because when you sign an agreement and you're working with super confidential material, I don't think that your presupposition should be like, oh, I can just take this to my next job. So I think, but I think a lot, I totally get what you're saying.
So go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I think this gets back to my earlier question about how does pattern and practice, like if there's, well, yeah, I brought the play call report as an example of what we do. Like if that's something that you've seen everybody do, because everyone does it, are you like, I don't think there's much question that it technically triggers some of the stuff in kind of these broadly written NDAs. My question is okay, well, if no one makes a fuss about that, is it really proprietary? Which gets back to the question earlier. And again, technically yes, but in practice no. And how do you adjudicate that?
I would add, Seth, to one of your comments, and maybe as a question or maybe just as a comment, when you were saying about how the commissioner and the commissioner's office and the league does not enjoy the opportunity to be regulating this sort of thing, I would say that it's probably equally true that they sure as heck don't want the courts doing it either. So
it's probably true. Yeah, they're not enjoying this either. Right? Yeah.
But as a fan, I can tell you, I'd be really excited to see this get into a discovery phase, right? Like, I think people on the outside of the league are watching this case with like eyes open, like super excited to see where this could potentially lead. In some ways, I think it's actually going to be a little beneficial to the league interest at large, right? Like, this is a heck of a juicy storyline for the deadest part of the offseason, at least before the World Cup starts. I think it's, I don't know if all publicity is good publicity really applies, but I do think in this particular case, it might.
Adam is saying, gee, I had this great idea for this in-season tournament. Why didn't I think of this? Is that real?
I think no matter what happens, it's true that the NBA just rules the offseason, no matter what happens. I will also say that I'm also still bitter about the Andrea Bargnani trade, but I haven't sued anyone.
So, I get that in there. Thank you, both of you, for a very compelling discussion about this. I want to, before we sign off, ask each of you, is there any closing statement you would like to make to the jury? Or anything additional you want to bring up and discuss, or anything at all that you want to add? If not, we'll thank you again.
I just wanted to say what a pleasure it was to be on, and appreciate you reaching out, and appreciate being up here with Seth to trying to dissect this. And it'll be an interesting one to watch, because it's not every day that I get an opportunity to talk about IP stuff and sports stuff together. So yeah, I'm just happy to have the conversation, and look forward to seeing how it plays out.
I am very interested to see, as the factual allegations develop, whether there actually is something extra special that was sort of involved in this beyond kind of beyond a particularly ham-handed and clumsy way of doing this, or there's actual, like, it is actually more towards the proprietary stuff. If there's actual like code involved, if there's actual really internal intelligence involved, because again, you stuff where it seems like, oh, strategic, a playbook, a play call, stuff everyone knows about everyone else already anyway, and it's certainly written in the complaint to sound very sinister, and it might be, but it's just sort of the from having experience reading complaints and working with this material, as of yet I haven't seen an allegation that convinces me, that would convince me otherwise.
Well, I again want to thank each of you for incredible, wonderful contributions to this discussion. And as I've said several times, we're really early on this. So I would hope, as this progresses or doesn't progress, who knows what's going to happen, that we can have you back to analyze and comment on things as they move ahead in this area. So that's my invitation, and those are my thanks. And Michael, do you want to add anything?
Not at all. I just want to say thanks, guys. This was super interesting, and can't wait to see where it goes.